There's a riddle, probably the most famous riddle in history, called the Riddle of the Sphinx. According to Greek mythology, the Sphinx was a mythical creature with the head of a human and the body of a lion. The Sphinx guarded the entrance to the Greek city of Thebes. As the myth goes, she would devour all travelers who couldn't answer a riddle that went something like, "What is the creature that walks on 4 legs in the morning, 2 legs at noon, and 3 in the evening?" The answer is man, or a person, who literally crawls on all fours as a baby and metaphorically crawls throughout childhood, then walks on 2 legs well into adulthood, and finally gets around the assistance of a cane upon becoming elderly. Today, I could ask a modern variation on the riddle of the Sphinx. What is the only state in the country, the only place in the world, in which a 16-year-old convicted of murder is guaranteed to experience all 3 cycles of the riddle of the Sphinx in prison? Entering as a child, remaining throughout adulthood, and not having any chance of being released until after she's hit retirement age. As is demonstrated by the case of Centoya Brown, the answer to this riddle is Tennessee. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. For the past 2 months, I've been blogging exclusively about a single case, the Centoya Brown case. This Monday was Centoya's 30th birthday, and unless there's a change in her case or Tennessee law, it will be another 38 years before she has any chance of being released, starting at age 68. But that might all be about to change, and you can help. Let's start by examining Centoya's case, and then look at the broader issues at play. Here's Joy Reid laying out the basics of Centoya's case.
This week, celebrities, including Rihanna, have taken to social media to champion the cause of Centoya Brown, who was 16 years old when she shot and killed a man who had taken her to his home and paid her for sex in August of 2004. Brown was tried as an adult and was convicted of first-degree murder and aggravated robbery after prosecutors argued that she killed Allen in order to steal his money and guns. But what the jury never heard was the story of Brown's life up to that moment. Born to a mother who said she drank every day of her pregnancy, the repeated rapes, emotional and physical abuse she says she endured as a teenager at the hands of the 24-year-old drug dealer and pimp who forced Brown into prostitution.
Centoya's story starts back in 1987. Her mother, Georgina Mitchell, or Gina, was a 16-year-old Caucasian woman who was pregnant with a child of an African-American man. Gina left home and traveled to Clarksville, Tennessee to live with her sister. Gina's mother told her she could return home on one condition, quote, without the black baby growing in her belly. Instead, Gina remained in Clarksville and began hanging around Ellenette Brown's house, which was known as a gathering spot for neighborhood teens. According to Gina, while pregnant, quote, I abused alcohol regularly, consuming a fifth of hard liquor every day it was available to me and doing whatever it took to make sure it was available to me every day. Gina also didn't have any prenatal care during her pregnancy. Her only trip to the doctor during that pregnancy was the day that she gave birth to Centoya. Complicating matters were mental health issues. Here's Gina testifying at a hearing in Centoya's case about her family's history of mental disorders and suicidal ideations.
Bipolar, personality disorder, suicidal, manic depressive, which is in guarded condition. At times I've had homicidal thoughts for people that have hurt me. I've been raped, and I've always, you know, wanted to do things to them for hurting me. And
let me ask you this. You actually attempted suicide in the past?
Yes, ma'am.
What does this tattoo on your arm say?
Suicide.
And Dr. Burnetta will address, but is there a history of suicide throughout your family, actual suicides?
Yeah, my mom shot herself in front of me when I was in second grade. Her sister, which is my aunt, just killed herself with a shotgun. My grandpa, he shot himself in the head. My Aunt Shirley, she's tried to kill herself God knows how many times.
So that's the nature half of the nature-nurture dichotomy. Here's forensic psychiatrist William Burnett describing the nurture half in the documentary Me Facing Life.
So that's the half having to do with genetics. The half having to do with early development is, I guess, is interesting in the sense that, you know, the basic theory is that people have trouble during achieving these first two stages of life, and that's ages 0 to 3 or 4. And that's exactly the point in Centoya's life that was just totally messed up. First of all, she lived with a number of different people. I was trying to keep track of the different caretakers, but I mean, there were 6 or 7 different people.
Specifically, after Centoya was born, Gina became addicted to crack cocaine. She was also doing some prostituting. When Centoya was about 6 to 8 months old, Gina dropped Centoya off with Elinette Brown, asking if she could watch her for a while. Elinette agreed, but days turned into weeks, and then weeks turned into months. Gina was in and out of prison and didn't return to see Centoya. Elinette's husband was deployed overseas, and Elinette worked during the day. Because she wasn't technically Centoya's guardian, Elinette couldn't take her to daycare, so she would simply drop her off with an elderly neighbor during the day. Eventually, Elinette got guardianship of Centoya. But then, Gina reappeared when Centoya was 18 months old and kidnapped her. Months later, Gina's sister called Elinette, told her Gina was in Georgia and was strung out, couldn't take care of Centoya anymore. Elinette brought Centoya home, but things didn't quite work out. Here's Centoya describing her adoptive father in Me Facing Life.
And my dad's asshole is the only word you need to describe him.
Like, what do you mean? Like, what would he do?
Like it, you know what I'm saying? Like it, stuff like that.
He would sort of slap you?
Sometimes he had no reason, just... He would actually say, I swear for God, because I felt like it.
I'm sorry, he said what?
Because I felt like it when I asked him why he hit me.
Oh, I see. That's what he would say.
Yeah.
Centoya went into more detail about this event in an interview with Dr. Natalie Novick-Brown, saying, quote, I used to get scared when my dad would come home. He was unpredictable. It was his alcoholism. I didn't know if he'd be nice or mean to me. I remember one time, we were on the pool deck, and his friends were there. He wanted me to get him a beer. I got it for him and gave it to him, and he smacks me in the back of the head. I asked him why he did that, and he said he just felt like it. You never knew what his attitude was going to be. My mom would spank me when I got in trouble, but these were normal spankings. My dad was completely different. It was like he was taking his anger out on me. He'd hit me out of frustration. When he was angry, it was like a release for him. Sometimes he left welts on me. At another point in the interview, she said that, quote, he was miserable. He drank a lot throughout my life. He was better when I was younger, around 8 and 9, but when I was 10, he started being a jerk. I weighed 125 pounds, but he called me fatso and dum-dum, even though I made straight A's. This last comment by Centoya relates to a tragic dichotomy in her life. She was an A student. She played the trombone for a year. She was a cheerleader. She played soccer. She has an IQ of 134, which means that she has very superior intelligence. In fact, she's only 6 points away from a 140 IQ, which is genius or near genius level. But Centoya also has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD, based on her mother drinking when she was pregnant. As you might be able to tell from the word spectrum, there are a variety of lifelong effects that can result from a mother's alcohol consumption that alters the development of a fetus. One frequent effect is a deficit in the ability to problem solve. Here's Dr. Luther Robinson, a pediatrician, describing the issue in the video, Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, the Biological Basis.
The profiles of children and teenagers and adults who have fetal alcohol syndrome relate to difficulties with problem solving. If you visited my apartment and I said, get the knives and forks, you would think the knives and forks likely are in the kitchen, in the cupboard, in a drawer with the spoons. And that's how we would problem solve, solve that problem, that challenge. But for a person who has fetal alcohol syndrome, some of those associations don't seem to fit. So that problem solving is especially difficult. So a matter, whereas you and I just take for granted, go to the kitchen, look in the drawer, pull it open, look for the spoons and forks, and here's a knife. That doesn't happen with some people with fetal alcohol syndrome. Let's pull out the knife. It's working almost by trial and error to come up with an answer.
The tragedy for Centoya Brown was that her high IQ hid the fact that she had FASD and prevented her from getting treatment. As Dr. Brown noted in her report on Centoya, her higher IQ masked her underlying adaptive deficits, leading others to perceive her behavioral dysfunction as intentional rather than biologically limited. Dr. Brown tested Centoya on one of the Vineland adaptive behavior skills, which measures a person's adaptive behavior by looking at domains like daily living skills and socialization. She concluded as follows. An IQ number reflects how well an individual is able to respond to intellectual questions within a structured test environment. Adaptive assessment reflects how well that person can apply their intelligence and other cognitive abilities in day-to-day living and real-world challenges. In Centoya's case, there is objective, standardized evidence that she has pervasive cognitive deficits that fall well below her IQ, thereby setting a biological limit on her capacity to use her intellect in unstructured, unfamiliar situations. Because her neurocognitive impairments involved significant impulse control and adaptive deficits that affected social functioning, Centoya Brown was unable to use her intellect to cope effectively with the adversities and unpredictable events in her childhood environment, despite pro-social parenting and nurturing from her adoptive mother. Accordingly, her life history reflected a biological incapacity from early childhood on to behave in an appropriate and adaptive manner when left to her own devices in unstructured or unfamiliar situations. It is noteworthy that Centoya Brown's Vineland results are remarkably consistent with individuals diagnosed with FASD who have IQs in the 70s or lower. Thus, standardized adaptive assessment indicates that while Centoya Brown may have been 16 years old chronologically at the time of the incident offense, she functions socially and behaviorally like a 12-year-old child. So let's get to that offense. Throughout her teenage years, Centoya had troubles with the law. She committed vandalism. She committed assault. She used drugs and alcohol. She was diagnosed with polysubstance abuse and dependence. 3 weeks before her offense, Centoya was 16 years old and living with her friend Tasha and Tasha's boyfriend Jerry. According to Centoya, Jerry raped her repeatedly. Centoya had also met a 24-year-old man who went by the name of Cutthroat. Cutthroat physically and sexually abused Centoya and would pimp her out. Again, here's a clip from the documentary, Me Facing Life.
I remember one time, the first time he did something to me is when he choked me and I passed out. Because he said I thought he was a joke.
Mm-hmm. What else did he do to you?
He talked real bad to me and jacked me up. He pulled me by my hair and dragged me and stuff. He put guns up to me, told me to strip and stuff like that, getting that out of the people.
Do you ever have sex with the guys?
When I cut, put a fucking gun up to me, I did.
Did he have sex with you too?
Yeah, he had sex with me. Sometimes I don't want to have sex with him. He'd still fuck me. I'd be crying and everything.
So how come you stayed with him?
You're not listening. I'm not getting money. He wasn't going to let me go nowhere. He's told me he'd kill me. He knows where my mom lives. And I know the dude choked me until I almost passed out. He's not afraid to kill me.
On August 7th, 2004, Cutthroat told Centoya that she was slacking and that she needed to get on the grind. Centoya went to a local Sonic, which was known as a hotspot for prostitutes. There, she was approached by 43-year-old Nashville real estate agent Johnny Mitchell Allen. She gave him a price of $200 for sex. He countered with $100. They met in the middle. He bought her some food from Sonic and took her to his house. Here's another clip from Me Facing Life.
Did you see any guns in the house?
Yes, I seen two shotguns downstairs, and he showed me a chrome gun with a black handle.
Where were you when he showed you that?
I was sitting at the table eating my food.
You tend to be a nervous person.
Yeah.
Was there anything that made you especially nervous that night?
Just how he was acting, just how he talked. It's like the way he talked, how he was just so important and stuff. And then me, I look at myself, who am I? Who am I to him? It's like, then he talks about the guns and stuff. If he does something to me, I'm sitting here thinking, what can I do? I'm in his house. Ain't nobody gonna know where I'm at. My mom and them, they don't know where I'm at. The people that I stay with, Chico and them, they don't know where I'm at. Nobody's gonna know what happens to me. Cut, he doesn't care. He doesn't even know who I left with. And all this is just running through my mind, and I'm just a nervous wreck.
Mr. Allen was asleep and facing away from you when you shot him.
No, sir.
All right, what I want you to do is to explain to the court how you have a gun in your purse on the nightstand, correct?
Right.
You don't want to do this. You don't want to be here. So you felt like if you tried to leave, he would harm you.
Right.
And your belief in that is based on the fact that he told you he had some guns and he's a sharpshooter.
Not only that, but the way
also,
he was acting.
Well, all I know about his activities is what you've told us, and that's really all we'll ever know, Ms. Brown.
Right.
Since you killed him, the only thing we know is that he took you to Sonic, he bought you food, he took you home, you used his bathroom, you felt comfortable doing that, you ate with him, you felt comfortable doing that, you sat on the couch and watched TV with him, you felt comfortable doing that, you got in the bed and at least one time went to sleep while he was there, you felt comfortable doing that.
I never went to sleep.
What happened next?
At first he was just stroking me, but then it's like he just grabbed me like in between my legs, like he just grabbed it real hard and he just gave me this look. It was like a very fierce look. Mm-hmm. And then it just sent these chills up my spine. I'm thinking he's gonna hit me or do something like that, but then he rolls over and reaches, like he's reaching to the side of the bed or something, so I'm thinking, now he's not gonna hit me, he's gonna get a gun.
And what did you do at that time?
I just grabbed the gun and I shot him.
So, was this self-defense? This was the claim that Santoya raised at trial, but the jury rejected it. Possibly the biggest thing working against her was the fact that she took Allen's wallet and some of his guns before she left his house and drove away in his truck. Now, the state would claim that this was evidence of a planned murder robbery. Santoya, on the other hand, would claim that she stumbled upon the wallet while trying to get the keys to the truck and took the guns because she was worried that Allen was still alive and would burst through the front door before she could drive away. So is it possible that based upon her fetal alcohol syndrome and everything she had faced in her life, Santoya feared for her life and grabbed some of Allen's belongings while still in fear? Forensic psychiatrist William Burnett thinks so. Here's a final clip from Me Facing Life.
Tell that's the way people are. Now, how did this manifest itself when this guy, Johnny, was killed? See, I think that some of these characteristics affected the behavior, specifically her affective instability. In other words, becoming suddenly frightened about the situation she was in, and her paranoia, which is part of this condition. So I think it's possible to say that the criminal act was related to her personality disorder.
Now, the goal of this episode is not to argue for Santoya's innocence or her guilt. The simple fact is that she was found guilty of murdering Johnny Allen, and that conviction has been upheld in appeal. But there are some other indisputable facts in this case. One, Santoya Brown has been described as a model inmate. Two, she mentors other female prisoners. Three, she obtained her associate's degree through Lipscomb University's in-jail program and is working toward her bachelor's degree while she volunteers on juvenile justice issues. The Lipscomb program is the Lipscomb Initiative for Education, or LIFE program, in which up to 30 traditional students each semester enroll in a liberal arts course that's held on-site at the Tennessee Prison for Women and study alongside residents of that prison. According to the program's webpage, quote, "The mix of students and specifically designated coursework provides academic and character-building benefits for both students at the prison and students from campus." Here's a Tennessean interview with Michelle Lockwood, another graduate of the LIFE program.
My name is Michelle Lockwood. I'm a Lipscomb student in the LIFE Academy program. I'm in the 13th year of a life sentence, and I'm 34 years old. I think the Lipscomb program has given me the courage to stand up and actually go out there and fight for the change that needs to be made. I think society's ideas and sometimes that the way that they think should happen or the way that they think things are happening maybe aren't in line. And I think that I can, you know, take this and build some sort of platform to be able to just help people realize, hey, not everybody in prison is a bad person, and not everybody in prison needs the key thrown away on them. They've helped build me up in here because I've looked at things and I've thought about, you know, what happens if I have to stay here for the rest of my life? What happens if I never get to walk out those doors and use what this program has afforded me? But I know that even if that if happens, that I have the tools and the capabilities here to be able to help other people who will get to go out there. I can encourage somebody else who will be able to make parole. I'll be able to tutor somebody in the GED program to be able to get their GED to help better their families.
As Lockwood notes, she's playing a game of if, which is the irony of the Lipscomb Life program. In any other state, someone like Lockwood, who is convicted at age 21 and given a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, would have some shot to be released before she reached retirement age. But in Tennessee, an individual sentenced to life with the possibility of parole must serve 51 years before even being eligible for possible release. For Lockwood, that means she's not eligible for release until age 73. Now, Centoya Brown was given the same sentence, and for a juvenile offender like her, that sentence is even more aberrational. Why? Well, let's get the lay of the land. In Tennessee, if a minor like Centoya Brown is convicted of first-degree murder, the court has two and only two sentencing options. The first is life without the possibility of parole. In any other country, this wouldn't be a possibility. I spoke with Connie De La Vega, a professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. In 2008, she co-authored an article entitled Sentencing Our Children to Die in Prison.
Well, we looked at the country, we looked at all the countries around the world and found that the United States is the only country that has offenders who were under 18 at the time they committed their crime serving a sentence of life without parole. There is a one state in Australia where there's a question about its law and whether it authorizes such a sentence, but we are not aware of anyone serving that sentence there.
3 years after this article, the Supreme Court announced a landmark decision that would change juvenile sentencing forever. Evan Miller and Contrell Jackson were 14 years old when they committed a murder that would lead to them getting life without parole sentences. In oral argument before the Supreme Court, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative claimed that these sentences were unconstitutional.
The decision-making of children, that the thinking of children is categorically different. They're not thinking three steps ahead. They're not thinking about consequences. They're not actually experienced enough with the world to understand how they deal with their frustrations in the same way that an adult is. And so their judgments about what they intend to do, their declarations, mean something very, very different. And one of the factors that we haven't talked about that I just want to emphasize is it's not just their inherent internal attributes, it's also the external circumstances that they find themselves in. Contrell Jackson was born in a household where there was nothing but violence and guns and people shooting each other. His grandmother shot his uncle, his mother shot a neighbor, his brother shot someone, they were all put to jail. But unlike an adult, these children don't have the ability to escape. A child of 14 cannot leave his criminogenic or violent environment. They have no control over that.
In its opinion in Miller versus Alabama, the Supreme Court agreed. Now, they didn't declare juvenile life without parole sentences per se unconstitutional, but they did say that mandatory juvenile life without parole sentences are unconstitutional, and that instead, there has to be an individualized sentencing hearing before giving a juvenile this country's second harshest penalty. Simply put, the Miller opinion started a revolution. Now, 6 years later, half of all states and D.C. have actually or constructively declared a juvenile life without parole sentence per se unconstitutional, and that's not even including New Mexico, which currently has no juvenile lifers. And many of these states come from the same region as Tennessee, Arkansas, Kentucky, West Virginia, and my state of South Carolina. Many of these bans on juvenile life without parole sentences have come in the last year or two. In a prior episode, Rabia interviewed Xavier McElrath Bay, who ended up being instrumental in Arkansas passing its ban.
I was told that I would never have a life.
Sitting in front of the House Judiciary Committee, Xavier McElrathby spoke about the abuse he endured as a child growing up in Chicago at the hands of many, including his stepfather.
Oftentimes he would come in, we'll get underneath the covers and we'll hide. But he would punch through the covers.
He was there Tuesday supporting a bill to end sentences of life without parole for minors. The bill's sponsor points out that while Arkansas ranks 32nd among the states in population, only five have more juveniles in prison serving life sentences.
I don't feel that a 14, 15-year-old should necessarily be sentenced to the rest of their life.
All.
But now, based upon a bill passed last year, a life without parole sentence is no longer a possibility for juveniles in Arkansas.
I'm a poor old girl, alone in this world, no one can tell my troubles to. Every girl I know has a boy, one that she can call her own.
Tennessee, on the other hand, remains part of the other half of states that do still allow for a sentence of juvenile life without parole. And that takes us to the second sentencing option for a juvenile in the volunteer state convicted of first-degree murder. 51 to life, or a sentence of life imprisonment with the possibility of parole only after someone like Centoya Brown serves 51 years of her sentence, meaning that Centoya would be 68 years old before she's even eligible for release. In an article in the Times Free Press, Marsha Levick of the Juvenile Law Center speculated that Tennessee might have the harshest juvenile sentencing law in the country, and this is the subject I've been researching for the past 2 months with great assistance from Kristen Anderson, a law student at the University of Tennessee. So, does Tennessee have the harshest juvenile sentencing laws in the nation? The answer is yes, by a good margin. First, as noted, half of all states in D.C. don't even allow for a juvenile life without parole sentence, so Tennessee is already on the harsher side of the juvenile sentencing divide. That leaves us with the other half of states, which still allow for the possibility of a juvenile life without parole sentence, but also allow for the court to impose a lighter sentence. In Virginia, a court has suspended all but 3 years of a life sentence. In Idaho and Mississippi, a juvenile homicide offender could be eligible for parole after serving 10 years. In Nebraska, Ohio, Washington, and Wisconsin, a juvenile can be eligible for parole after serving 20 years, and Maryland judges have similarly suspended all but 20 years of juvenile life sentences in some cases. And in Arizona, Florida, Louisiana, Michigan, Missouri, and North Carolina, there's eligibility for parole after 25 years as a possibility. So that's 12 out of these 25 states that allow for release after 25 years or less, and that's not even counting New Hampshire and Illinois, which haven't clarified their laws yet, but have begun resentencing juveniles who are given life without parole sentences. In Illinois, one of those individuals is Jacqueline Montañez. Her father was the member of a gang who groomed her to be a hit woman. Montañez became a member of the female branch of the Maniac Latin Disciples at age 13 and killed two rival gang members at age 15. Here's Montañez describing her situation.
I don't even like using my childhood as a crutch for what I did. But the difference between me and them is I was trained to be a killer. This is not a life I want. This is a life I was given. I always wanted to be a police officer. That was what I wanted to do as growing up. But I wasn't able to do that because I became one of the bad boys. That's what I was supposed to do. So it made me really emotional in trial at sentencing because I wanted everybody to know that the old me, that's not me. I'm not that child. I'm not a monster. I have emotions, I have feelings, and I'm sorry.
The sentencing hearing Montañez is describing was her 2016 resentencing hearing after Miller v. Alabama. She'll now be released after serving 6.5 more years from the date of that hearing. And she wants to help others in her position.
The law changed and it brought me back. My goal is to try to change some laws to get some of these girls out of here. You have girls that came in so young and are still here. And you have people that been here for 30, 40, 50 years, and nobody's trying to help them. And they're just like, I can't give up on them here. My goal today is to go out there and finally help the kids that couldn't, like, what they couldn't do for me as a child, I want to help somebody else.
As Montañez notes, there are some juvenile offenders who have served 30, 40, and even 50 years. And in some states, that's unlikely to change. Alabama, Georgia, Minnesota, Oregon, and New Mexico only allow for the possibility of release after 30 years. And then, there are four states in which a juvenile homicide offender has no hope of release until after serving more than 30 years. In Indiana, based upon sentencing credit, a juvenile homicide offender can be released after serving 33 years and 274 days. In Pennsylvania, a juvenile has to serve 35 years before being eligible for release, although it's important to note that in 2017, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania ruled that juvenile life without parole sentences are presumptively unconstitutional. Next, we have Oklahoma, where a juvenile homicide offender is not eligible for release until serving 38.25 years. Oklahoma, though, now requires a jury instruction in juvenile homicide cases that, quote, no person who committed a crime as a juvenile may be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole unless you find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is irreparably corrupt and permanently incorrigible. So we have this collection of states that are on the harsh end of juvenile sentencing, not allowing for the possibility of release until a juvenile homicide offender has served about 34 to 38 years in prison. And then you have Tennessee. As I've noted, in the volunteer state, a juvenile offender like Santoya Brown isn't eligible for parole until after serving 51 years. That's 12.75 years longer than the next harshest state of Oklahoma. Putting that into context, in Tennessee, Santoya Brown, or anyone convicted of first-degree murder at age 16, isn't eligible for parole until she is 68 years old. In the second strictest state of Oklahoma, that age is lowered to 55 years. In the vast majority of states, that age is 47. And in plenty of states, juvenile homicide offenders can be eligible for release after serving 20 years or less, meaning a 16-year-old would be eligible for release at age 37 or younger. So is there reason for hope for Santoya Brown? There are reasons to believe the answer is yes. The first is a clemency petition.
Fox 17 News' coverage of the Santoya Brown case sparked a renewed Free Santoya Brown movement nationwide, with celebrities like Rihanna and LeBron James calling for Tennessee's governor to set her free. She's in prison for life for killing a man who bought her for sex. Governor Haslam tells Nashville Public Radio he's aware of the growing campaign to let her out.
We actually haven't done any clemencies yet, but we'll be looking at them for next year. So I would be really surprised by the end of the year. I think we're just starting to gather the information.
The governor's office tells Fox 17 News tonight he's expecting her clemency petition to go to the parole board first. A growing team of pro bono attorneys and former judges are crafting Brown's clemency appeal and tell me they'll file it before the end of the year.
Santoya's lawyers did file the clemency petition by the end of the year. It asked for Governor Bill Haslam to reduce her conviction from first-degree murder to second-degree murder on the ground that the killing was not premeditated. Haslam hasn't granted any clemency petitions since becoming governor in early 2011, but the hope is that he might grant Santoya's petition at the end of his second term in early 2019. The second reason to hope for Santoya Brown is a petition for writ of habeas corpus filed with the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. As noted, Miller v. Alabama held that a court can impose a mandatory sentence of life without parole on a juvenile offender. Well, according to Santoya's attorneys, a sentence of 51 to life is the functional equivalent of life without parole, making it unconstitutional. And there's some reason to believe this argument might be successful. It's based upon what I'll call the Princess Bride argument. In The Princess Bride, Prince Humperdinck has Wesley strapped to a device known as the machine, which has a lever that can be raised from 1 to 50. When the lever is turned to 1, the machine sucks away 1 year of the victim's life, with each tick of the lever corresponding to another year taken away.
As you know, the concept of the suction pump is centuries old. Well, really, that's all this is, except that instead of sucking water, I'm sucking life. I've just sucked 1 year of your life away. I might one day go as high as 5, but I really don't know what that would do to you, so let's just start with what we have.
In 2010, Deborah LaBelle brought a class action lawsuit on behalf of 12 Michigan inmates who had been given mandatory life without parole sentences based upon crimes committed when they were juveniles. During the course of that litigation, which is still ongoing, LaBelle realized that she was confronting a real-world example of the machine.
Well, the first thing that started me on the study was the fact that from the time that I started working on this, I had a number of clients pass, and then I started looking at how many youth had died serving this unconstitutional sentence, and there were 12 of them in Michigan. And based on that, I started to see the aging of my class population, and I was deeply concerned that we move quickly and that we, this was pre-Miller, and to that we file a federal civil rights action to get almost immediate, to try to get immediate relief, to get people to see the parole board as I saw an aging population serving, you know, a sentence that after the Graham case I believed was unconstitutional.
So what did LaBelle find? Well, the average life expectancy of a person born in the U.S. is about 79 years. The United States Sentencing Commission has calculated a life expectancy for all prisoners of 64 years and uses that number for sentencing decisions. LaBelle, the project director of the ACLU of Michigan Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative, dug into the numbers in Michigan for adult inmates given life sentences. For this subset of the prison population, life expectancy dips to 58.1 years. And then there were the juvenile lifers, the population LaBelle was representing in her lawsuit. For that group, life expectancy was lower still, 50.6 years. Put simply, when a juvenile is given a life sentence, on average, she has more than a third of her life sucked away. Indeed, LaBelle was aware of only one juvenile lifer in Michigan who had even reached the age at which Cyntoia Brown will first be eligible for release.
I know that we have one person and who has, I think there's only one person who has reached the age of 70. And he, unfortunately, is in a wheelchair and is in permanent hospital care and has been for many years.
I led this episode with the Riddle of the Sphinx and noted that Cyntoia Brown and other juvenile lifers in Tennessee aren't eligible for release until they are metaphorically walking on three legs in the evening with the assistance of a cane. LaBelle's data suggests that Tennessee's juvenile lifers won't come out of their cells on any legs at all. And even putting aside this Princess Bride argument, some courts have found that a sentence that requires incarceration until an inmate is in her late 60s is effectively a life sentence. In a 2015 opinion, the Supreme Court of Connecticut wrote that, quote, a juvenile offender is typically put behind bars before he has had a chance to exercise the rights and responsibilities of adulthood, such as establishing a career, marrying, raising a family, or voting. Even assuming the juvenile offender does live to be released, after a half century of incarceration, he will have irreparably lost the opportunity to engage meaningfully in many of these activities and will be left with seriously diminished prospects for his quality of life for the few years he has left. A juvenile offender's release when he is in his late 60s comes at an age when the law presumes that he no longer has productive employment prospects. Indeed, the offender will be age qualified for Social Security benefits without ever having had the opportunity to participate in gainful employment. Any such prospects will also be diminished by the increased risk for certain diseases and disorders that arise with more advanced age, including heart disease, hypertension, stroke, asthma, chronic bronchitis, cancer, diabetes, and arthritis. This is a compelling conclusion, but one that's much likelier to come from a court in the Northeast than the Southeast. But this takes us to a third option, and it's both an option that has bipartisan support and the possibility to help not only Cyntoia Brown, but also all juvenile offenders in Tennessee. Here's a clip from a piece from The Tennessean by Dan Bierman, the same filmmaker who did Me Facing Life.
We refer this as our juvenile justice bill. It would eliminate juveniles from being sentenced to life without parole. Those who have been tried and convicted as adults and sentenced, it would give them an opportunity to have their sentence reviewed by a judge after 15 years.
That's after the time that their brain has fully developed.
Once that frontal lobe develops, once they have impulse control, once they are able to make better choices, they are absolutely different people than the people that we sentenced to 51 years in prison.
There's a maturity in your thinking as you grow and you realize, I probably shouldn't do that, or this is going to affect the rest of my life.
They are children.
The male voices you heard in that clip belong to Doug Overby and Jeremy Faison. They're two Republican representatives who introduced the bill, which, as noted, would have eliminated juvenile life without parole in Tennessee and given juveniles like Santoya Brown eligibility for parole after serving 15 years. Now, eventually, that bill was amended to 20 years and then 30 years before it was tabled. But you get the idea. These Republican lawmakers wanted to lower the age at which a juvenile can be released from prison. Why? Well, among other reasons, the change is fiscally conservative. Every year that Santoya Brown is incarcerated costs the state of Tennessee about $25,000. If the initial proposal passed, Santoya would be eligible for release at age 32, or 2 years from now. That's $900,000 less than if she's released after serving 51 years. And if the proposal for eligibility for parole after 20 years passed and Santoya were released in 7 years at age 37, the state would save $775,000. So why hasn't the bill passed? Well, as you can imagine, the families of victims of juvenile homicide offenders are often strongly opposed to their early release. And then there are those who argue that we shouldn't open the prison doors to juvenile homicide offenders until they're well into their sentences. As a counterpoint to this latter argument, however, it's important to note that the proposed change in Tennessee law wouldn't simply throw open those doors. It would merely create the possibility of parole after a juvenile serves 15 or 20 years. And it's notoriously difficult to make parole. The most famous fictional representation of this case can be found in The Shawshank Redemption, in which Morgan Freeman's Red is denied parole twice after serving 20 and 30 years before finally making parole after 40 years on the basis of one of the most famous movie monologues in history.
I look back on the way I was then. A young, stupid kid who committed that terrible crime. I want to talk to him. I want to try to talk some sense to him. Tell him the way things are. But I can't. That kid's long gone, and this old man is all that's left. I gotta live with that.
It's unclear how old Red is supposed to be in the movie, but Morgan Freeman would have been about 56 years old when Shawshank was shot in the summer of 1993, about 6 years older than the life expectancy of a juvenile lifer in Michigan. And then there's Red's fellow inmate, Brooks Hatlin, who makes parole after 50 years and hangs himself because he can't adjust to life in the outside world. Add another year to Brooks Hatlin's prison term, or add another rung to the machine in The Princess Bride, and you get the minimum sentence of 51 years that Santoya Brown and other juvenile lifers in Tennessee must serve, with no exceptions. But as Red said in Shawshank, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. The bill in Tennessee didn't die. It was merely tabled. And it'll be reconsidered again this year. State Representative Ramesh Akbari and the Tennessee Black Caucus of state legislators have thrown their support behind the bill. If passed in its original form, Santoya Brown could be released in just 2 years. Last year, we made a call to listeners to contact the Missouri governor to stay the execution of Marcellus Williams when DNA evidence pointed toward his innocence. And you came through in spades, leading to an 11th-hour reprieve. Now, we're calling on you again. If this episode has convinced you that 51 to life is inhumane, please do something about it. Share this episode on social media. If you live in Tennessee, contact your local representative and let him or her know you want an end to 51 to life. If you know someone in Tennessee, share this episode with him or her so that she can contact her state representative. There are few chances for everyday citizens to make a difference in the criminal justice system, but this is one of them. And by doing so, you can bring justice not only for Santoya, but for every juvenile lifer in Tennessee who might deserve a second chance. Thanks so much for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. Next Monday, we'll be back with a brand new series in which we explore whether Chester Holman, a Philadelphia man who is 21 years old and had no criminal record, was wrongfully convicted of a 1991 murder in the city of brotherly love. I'd like to thank the following people for today's episode. Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by using the handle @UndisclosedPod. And the music you heard today comes from Tennessee artists. Willow Weep From Me by Mary Lou Williams, Come Right In by Lovie Austin and Ida Cox, Wild Women Don't Get the Blues by Ida Cox, Death Bell Blues by Tom Dixon, and the credit song is Cemetery Blues by Bessie Smith.